Welcome back for the third hour of Issues, Etc. In just a few minutes, we're going to be hearing from Senator Kit Bond of Missouri, reflecting upon the presidency of Ronald Reagan. Right after that conversation, we'll be talking about the Anglican Church of Canada's affirmation last week of same-sex relationships. That's the Anglican Church of Canada. We'll be talking with Father Paul Orrit, rector of St. Peter's Anglican Church, and that will be the subject. And then, immediately upon the heels of that conversation, Wesley Smith will join us to talk about embryonic stem cell research in light of the President Reagan's recent death. Wesley Smith of the Discovery Institute, he's written a recent column for National Review Online on that subject titled Cell Wars. First, a little earlier today, I had the opportunity to talk with Senator Kit Bond about the presidency of Ronald Reagan. He was kind enough to join us, and we began by talking about his reflections at the death of Ronald Reagan and his thoughts at the passing of this president. Here's Senator Kit Bond.
Well, great sadness and the loss of a true leader for America and the world. But knowing how he was suffering from Alzheimer's, it was a blessing for him and his family. And we also celebrate his accomplishments. He had a message of hope, opportunity, and freedom for America and the world. And he left a lasting mark on our economy, on the shape of the world, and also on the improved spirit of the American people.
In 1986, you unseated a Democrat. You took the seat of a Democrat to take your place in the Senate. How important was Ronald Reagan's popularity at the time to your victory there as senator in Missouri?
Well, he helped, no question. He was in three times, campaigned for me. I had a very close race, ultimately won by about, I think, about 53%, but he helped a great deal.
And for others who, both in 1986 and then later in 1994, saw kind of a renewal of the Republican Party at the national level, how important was Reagan even after he was out of office for that 1994, in your estimation?
You know, the interesting thing, I'm running into more and more people who said really active, contributing government employees and political workers who got interested in government because of Ronald Reagan and joined the Republican Party. A member of my staff said that he hadn't thought anything about politics when he was in school, and Ronald Reagan convinced him to get into government to be a Republican. Our very fine Missouri Republican state chairman, Ann Wagner, said that it was Ronald Reagan who got her involved in politics. The young man who runs my Kansas City office, who was a state representative in Jefferson City, said that he was out of work in 1980, and when he saw Ronald Reagan, he decided to get involved in politics, and that got him involved.
Senator,
so there are many, many people like that who took Ronald Reagan's positive message and became involved, and they're continuing to make a difference.
I'm curious about that, Senator. How was it that Ronald Reagan, the oldest serving president, and then later to be the oldest president in U.S. history, how was he able to connect with young people at that time?
Well, it wasn't his age that appealed to him, obviously. He was a great communicator, as I've said, but he had a message of growth, hope, and opportunity that really resonated with the people. We had been in a period of malaise, almost 20 years. We had failed presidencies. People were really losing their confidence in government. We had ridiculously high inflation, stagnation. The economy wasn't growing. And Ronald Reagan came in with a very positive prescription, and people were looking for something that brought them hope. And it worked in the United States, and that message continues to reverberate throughout the world as we see more and more countries moving away from communism or authoritarianism towards freedom and more opportunity for their citizens.
Yesterday, as I was following the coverage of the Reagan legacy, I heard former Representative Newt Gingrich ask a very interesting question of history. He asked if Ronald Reagan had just decided to stay in California after his first failed bid for the presidency. How different would America be today? What would your answer to that question be?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't think we would be nearly as well off as we are now. We needed somebody not only to lead the government, but we needed to change the way we looked at things, and he did that. And he brought a positive view of government and of American opportunity to all of us, and I think that was a significant contribution. And without him, who knows? Maybe somebody else would have come along, but I don't know that anybody had the boldness of the vision that Ronald Reagan brought. And it was a bold vision, not just changing a few things here and there or doing a little more of this and a little less of that, but a very broad view that I think is has really served our country and served the world well.
We're talking with Senator Kit Bond of Missouri. He also serves on the Senate Select Intelligence Committee. Senator Bond, the greatest accomplishment during the Reagan presidency, those 8 years?
Oh, I'd say that's tough. I think most people would think about his efforts literally and figuratively in tearing down the Soviet communist walls. I think also very significantly he got the economy growing again, lowered taxes, and small businesses put that money to work and created jobs and gave us a real boost. So I think there was both a domestic and an international accomplishment, and the keeping the economy strong allowed him to continue to build the strength of the United States military so we could face foes, whether they be communism then or terrorism now.
Do you believe that if Ronald Reagan were sitting in the White House today, that he would be conducting the war on terrorism as it is being conducted today?
I think so. One of his, Michael Deaver, who said that, who was very close to Reagan as anybody, said he might be communicating more about it, but he had no question that his resolve would be the same.
On the issue of being the great communicator, he was called that already during his time, and of course, probably history will give him that label permanently. And you mentioned it before as well. I talked with someone yesterday who said Reagan himself was unsure about that title. Rather, he would defer to the greatness not of his communication skills, but of the ideas he was communicating. Talk about those ideas.
Well, that's exactly my point. He was a great communicator because he had a great message. And I go back to the basic formulation. He was very positive. He was a man of unfailing good humor, of concern for others, unfailingly gentlemanly and courteous. But he was championing hope, freedom, and opportunity. And those messages really resonated. And even if you're a very good speaker, if you don't have a good message, you probably can't communicate. He had the right message, and that made his communication so effective, and that's one of the reasons he was so effective.
What was Ronald Reagan like as a man, as a friend?
Very courteous, very kind. He was always, there are just hundreds of examples people have of how went out of his way to be thoughtful to people he met. He was always generous, always had a good humor, self-deprecating humor. He poked fun at himself. I'll never forget his line when he was running against Walter Mondale, and Mondale was claiming to be a Jeffersonian Democrat, and Ronald Reagan, recognizing his age, said, "My opponent claims to be like Thomas Jefferson. I knew Thomas Jefferson, and he's no Thomas Jefferson." And that totally disarmed people who were saying that Reagan is too old.
Finally, Senator, you serve on the Senate Select Intelligence Committee. Earlier today, U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft faced questions about a leaked memo regarding torture on Capitol Hill. Your thoughts on that? What is there to know there?
Well, number one, that was a hearing in it was either Armed Service. Oh, I think it was in the Judiciary Committee, what we work in the Intelligence Committee on a wide range of things. As I understand it, the question was asked what the limits were on gaining information from terrorists, and I understand that there may have been a legal opinion that looked at the controlling law at the time. But if you go back, you'll see that a number of leading Democrats, and I believe even Alan Dershowitz and others, said if we have to torture the terrorists to find out how to protect ourselves, we should do it. And right after 9/11, people were desperate to figure out how to get the information they needed. The statements by administration and by the Defense Department when that came out were that did not describe what they actually did. It was a memorandum describing the legal constraints. Clearly, the Geneva Convention, it does not apply to terrorists who do not fight under the flag of any country, do not wear uniforms, do not abide by the rules of warfare set out in the Geneva Convention. But to say that opinion was written does not suggest that those tactics were used. And I've seen in the papers today explicit flat statements that was not the operational guidelines under which our army operated, and that all of the prisoners in Iraq and Afghanistan, for example, were supposed to be treated in terms of the Geneva Convention, and that's why these photographed outrages are being prosecuted. We're prosecuting our own people for committing crimes because of their handling and their treatment of Iraqi prisoners.
Senator Kit Bond of Missouri, thank you very much for being our guest, and thank you again for your time.
Oh, thanks so much. Good to talk to you, sir. Thanks.
That was, of course, a conversation we had earlier with Senator Kit Bond. In about 20 minutes, we're going to talk with Wesley Smith about embryonic stem cell research in light of President Reagan's death. But first, we're going to speak about the Anglican Church of Canada's affirmation last week on Thursday of same-sex relationships. What kind of affirmation is this? Father Paul Orrett, he's rector of St. Peter's Anglican Church in Okotoks, Alberta, Canada, is our guest to talk about that. Father Orrett, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Well, thank you very much, Todd.
First of all, tell us exactly what was let's set the context. Is the Anglican Church of Canada more or less liberal, by and large, than the Episcopal Church USA, which has been so much in the news, both in the United States and internationally?
Well, up until last Thursday, I guess one would have argued that the Canadian Church is much more conservative. I think, by and large, Canadians tend to be more conservative than our American brothers and sisters. So the decision of the General Synod on Thursday of last week was of critical nature. It went way beyond the conservative nature of most churchmanship in the Anglican Communion.
Tell us about the measure that was approved Thursday last week, and in particular, if you would, explain this language, and I quote from the measure, that would affirm the integrity and sanctity of committed adult same-sex relationships.
Well, that's the major question that is moving throughout the Anglican Church of Canada at the present time. On the floor of General Synod, the two individuals who moved and seconded the particular amendment to the resolution, both of whom are clergy, and therefore with some degree of theological acumen, both argued that we shouldn't get particularly caught up in the words integrity and sanctity, and attempted to say to the General Synod that they are really not to be taken in the theological context, but rather in the pastoral context, whatever that means. For most of us in the conservative camp, however, it's difficult to understand how words like integrity, and particularly sanctity, which is one of the words so often used within the marriage rite and within the doctrine of marriage, could be taken in any other way but theological. However, on the floor of Synod, when there was an attempt to amend the amendment and delete the word sanctity and replace it with something else, that was defeated roundly. And so we're left, I think, at this point with the facts that stand before us, and that is that the General Synod chose particular words, and that those words mean exactly what everybody understands them to mean, and that is that the Synod, therefore, has made some theological statement. Certainly, in the eyes of the world communion, that has been exactly the interpretation, not less than 3 hours after the Synod moved that particular motion. Archbishop Drexel Gomez of the West Indies published a statement, and he happened at that particular time to be with a theological consultation, and in his statement he mentioned that it would be very difficult for them to understand how the word sanctity could be used in any other particular way. And subsequently, as I understand, I haven't seen a statement so far, but Archbishop Gregory Venables of the Southern Cone, on behalf of 22 primates of the Anglican World Communion, has issued a statement again with regard to the word sanctity, saying that it means to them what it means to most people. And so despite the spin that our own Anglican Church might be attempting at this point, in the eyes of most, they've said what they meant.
22 primates, if I'm not mistaken, is a very is a narrow majority of the 38, isn't it?
Well, in terms of 28 out of 38 primates, it would seem that, but those 22 represent something in the neighborhood of 60 million of the 75 million Anglicans. So they may be a slight majority in terms of the number of primates, but in terms of the world Anglican population, it's a significant majority.
You use the... So in other words, this action on the part of the Anglican Church of Canada does, in the minds of worldwide Anglicanism, put the ACC at odds with the worldwide communion?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, let me just read what Archbishop Drexel Gomez said. He said, and this is a quote from his statement to Orthodox Anglicans in Canada, "The amendment goes much further than the original motion in employing expressions which Scripture uses to describe marriage. In accordance with Scripture, your own prayer book uses this language in its marriage service. It is completely unacceptable to Bible-believing Orthodox Christians that same-sex unions are described as holy. Such language is reserved for marriage alone." Then he says, "The attempt to give, quote, committed adult same-sex relationships, end quote, the same theological stature as marriage exacerbates the crisis in the communion and will reap devastating consequences." So I think from that you could interpret that the primates of the global south understand the word in a particular way.
Why, you mentioned before, and you used the word spin on to describe the actions of the Anglican Church of Canada in this decision and their way of characterizing the language that they use to basically affirm same-sex unions. Why does the Anglican Church of Canada feel the need to spin this? Why not just straightforward language about an issue that it would seem is rather straightforward? Does this church or does it not affirm the practice of same-sex unions?
Well, Todd, when I'm using the word spin, I would say that I'm using that in the aftermath of the passing of the resolution, although one could certainly argue that on the floor of Synod there might have been some spin as well.
But why the need to spend?
Well, it's an interesting question, isn't it? There has been a dialogue in the Anglican Church of Canada for some 30 years on the issue of the place of, quote, gay and lesbian members of our church. And certainly in the most recent years, with the rather independent actions of the Diocese of New Westminster and its bishop, Michael Ingham, it's really brought this whole issue very much to the front burner. And so one would expect that people would just stand up and say what they mean. There's always been the confusion as to whether or not, for example, the blessing of same-sex unions is just another term for the marriage of same-sex couples. But the church has steered away from that because marriage is a matter of doctrine and requires significantly more work in terms of getting it passed as doctrine. Blessing is a much easier thing to be working with, and so the argument has usually been rerouted to talk about blessings. The major concern I have, and many of the conservatives have at this time, is that when you have two clergy who present a motion, and that motion has theologically loaded words, you need at that point, and from that point onwards, for all of those who have stood behind that motion to stand up and be held accountable, and not to try and suggest to people that what you really meant was something else. Now is the time to at least have the integrity to say, this is what we meant, and this is what we wanted to see happen. And whatever the consequences are of that resolution being passed, we accept them. And at this point, I think the spin is trying to get out from underneath some sense of accountability for the resolution that's being passed and the consequences that are now bearing down on the Anglican Church of Canada from the Worldwide Communion.
The Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, is the titular head of Worldwide Anglicanism. Has there been any statement from Rowan Williams or any of his spokespersons on this decision of the Anglican Church of Canada? We've only got about a minute here before we go to our first break.
Yeah. Archbishop Rowan Williams issued a statement on the Wednesday evening following the deferral of the amendment to defer. And at that point, he stated that he was rather happy. But I think he got caught with the amended resolution the next morning, and he has not issued a statement on that at this point.
When we come back from this break, what kind of a statement would be expected from Rowan Williams, and what will be the fallout in Worldwide Anglicanism as now here in North America, the second sector of the Anglican Communion in North America, the Anglican Church of Canada, joins the Episcopal Church USA in what is considered probably the hornet's nest of issues, and that is same-sex relationships. Is there any future of same-sex ordination in the Anglican Church of Canada? And we'll also be talking about, and we cannot divorce these two issues. This issue can't be divorced from the Canadian political context. There in Canada, the news has been of late of a lot of things about gay marriage in the political context. We'll talk about that when we come back with Father Paul Orrett.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most talk radio shows, but not for Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is listener-supported. That means we rely on you to pay the production, salaries, and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin asking you to prayerfully consider making a financial gift to Issues, Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You can donate by credit card, 1-800-737-0172, or you can donate by check, Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues Etc. needs your financial support. We depend upon you for the continuation and expansion of Issues Etc.
God, is this obvious from creation? Answers with Ken Ham, one of North America's most in-demand Christian conference speakers. Well, Ken, isn't it obvious from just looking at the world for us to conclude there must be a creator?
Well, the Bible tells us in Romans chapter 1 that it should be clearly seen to everyone that just by looking at the creation, we can come to the conclusion there must be a creator. That's why the Bible says we're without excuse if we don't believe in God. But if you want to understand who this God is and what his nature is, we can only do this by reading the Bible. You see, if you just looked at the present creation, you'd conclude that if there is a God, he must be an ogre. That's because this world is full of death, suffering, and disease. It's really not a nice place, even though there's beauty. The Bible reveals that the creation has fallen because of our sin in Adam. So we can learn that the reason for the death and suffering is because we rebelled against God. We also find out from His Word that God is love. Even though we rebelled against Him, He loved us so much that He became a man so He could pay the penalty for our sin.
Is it possible then that dinosaurs were living and dying millions of years before Adam came on the scene? Ken Ham provides some eye-opening answers in a free booklet available on our website, AnswersRadio.com. Next time you're in front of your computer, log on to AnswersRadio.com, where we have all sorts of free witnessing booklets available to you and to help you build you up in your faith. AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. Physical activity is important for young, growing bodies. Exercise helps the muscles, the lungs, the heart, and the mind. But for every minute your child sits in front of the TV, that is time away from running, jumping, and playing. To make sure your children get enough exercise, you may have to turn off the TV and play with them. That may mean going for a walk, throwing a ball, or playing tag. That is good for your children. It's good for you, and it's good for your relationship. Jesus loves your children enough to die on the cross for them. He also wants them to get the exercise they need. When you turn off the TV and actively play with your child, the love of God works through you to help your child become strong and healthy. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
Hi, this is Paul Clayton. I bring you news and information, inspirational Christian favorites, and conversations with great guests Monday through Friday on The Morning Show on AM 850 KFUO. Plus, short features like, By the Way, our thought for the day from the Reverend Paul Devanteer, Front Porch Parenting with Dr. Mary Mance Simon, commentary from Dr. Dale Meyer, it's the Meyer Minute, plus Your Creation Moment, features on The Morning Show on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. In about 5 minutes, we're going to be talking with Wesley Smith of the Discovery Institute about embryonic stem cell research in light of President Reagan's death and the former First Lady Nancy Reagan's support publicly for embryonic stem cell research that's been in the news. That's Wesley Smith here in just about 5 minutes. In the meantime, a few more minutes with Father Paul Orrett, rector of St. Peter's Anglican Church in Okotoks, Alberta, Canada. We're talking about the Anglican Church of Canada's affirmation last week of same-sex relationships. Father Orrett, let's explore outside the bounds of this particular affirmation that was made on Thursday last week. What is the mood of the Anglican Church in Canada on the issue of the ordination of gay and lesbian individuals?
I think that's probably as varied as the number of bishops that you might want to talk to. For the most part, it probably centers on whether or not there is any kind of overt sexual activity going on. And if an individual were to hold to some sense of discipline, then I think probably most bishops would not have a major problem. However, that's probably a slippery slope right now, and there are an increasing number of bishops who are not applying or do not seem to be applying any kind of sense of discipline to the issue.
Is there, are there instances where, if not on paper, yet in practice, there are openly and practicing gay or lesbian clergy in the Anglican Church of Canada?
Yes.
What about among the ranks of the bishops? Because, of course, we've had Gene Robinson down here as the first, and the term is always used very pointedly, first openly gay bishop in the Episcopal Church USA. What about among the ranks of the bishops there?
I would not be able to say anything about that, not for any other reason than I just simply don't know.
What was the general reaction among both the clergy and the laity of the Anglican Church of Canada when Gene Robinson was consecrated, well, elected and then confirmed and consecrated this last year in the Episcopal Church USA?
I think, again, that would probably differ according to who you're talking to. Certainly amongst the conservative element of the church, we would react unfavorably towards Gene Robinson's consecration. Others would probably see that as a step forward. In many ways, the kind of opinion demographic in Canada is probably not unlike that in the States. You have strong pockets of people who would say this is a step forward and this is God doing a new thing, but you'd also have a very conservative element saying this is not a direction that the church can go.
Finally, Father Orrett, with only 1 minute and no more, what about the broader Canadian political context where the issue of same-sex relationships is a matter of the state's concern? Set the context for us, if you would.
Well, increasingly, it seems to be coming on the political scene that same-sex marriages are going to be the wave of the future. That doesn't mean, certainly, that the church needs to go that way. In Alberta here, our Premier Ralph Klein is standing in opposition to that movement, but it only takes a certain amount of force before people begin to capitulate to certain policies and certain actions. So one just doesn't know which direction this is going to go.
Father Paul Orrett, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
And my pleasure, Todd. Thank you.
Father Paul Orrett is rector of St. Peter's Anglican Church in Okotoks, Alberta, Canada. Earlier today, I had the opportunity to talk with Wesley Smith. He, of course, is a regular guest here on Issues Etc. He's an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, author of several books, including Culture of Death, The Assault on Medical Ethics in America, and he's also recently written a column for National Review Online titled Cell Wars. To talk to him about embryonic stem cell research in light of President Reagan's recent death, I began by asking him about his thoughts on the former First Lady Nancy Reagan's support, recently publicly, for embryonic stem cell research.
You know, with the death of Ronald Reagan, I'm not going to criticize Nancy Reagan, who is a grieving elderly widow who is being told something that I think is not true. But I think we also need to reflect, as I've looked at some of the things Ronald Reagan supported, and I have to say, back when he was president, I was not a supporter of Ronald Reagan. But I'm looking at some of the things that he wrote, particularly in the Human Life Review, spring 1983. It's an article entitled Abortion and the Conscience of the Nation. And people can go to the Human Life Review website and get a copy of this. And he says things in here about abortion, which we're not talking about, but which would also apply to embryonic stem cell research and human cloning. For example, he says, quote, "We cannot diminish the value of one category of human life, the unborn, without diminishing the value of all human life." And, you know, a lot of what I've been, I was very surprised to read some of this, because he was saying things I'm now saying 20 years before I even thought.
We're having a little technical difficulty with Wesley Smith. We can see if we can restart that conversation with him here on Issues Etc.
From IVF treatments or cloned embryos, because that's where we're really heading, can be used as mere fodder, as harvestable crops, because we want to take their body parts and use them to create medical treatments, then we diminish the value of all human life. And we only need to look at the Terri Schiavo case and see that we want to dehydrate her to death because, according to state law of Florida, court order, because she's got a significant cognitive disability. And as I've described on your show before, Todd, there are now many in bioethics and in the organ transplant community that are urging that people like Terry Schiavo be killed for their organs. Because after all, people with greater use for them because they've got better consciousness need them more than the cognitively disabled or the unconscious patient. So if you start harvesting body parts at the beginning of life or make human life for that purpose, then it does spread and is spreading, as Reagan said, to diminish the value of all human life. And of course, the people who get diminished are the ones who can't defend themselves.
You have also responded to William Safire, nationally syndicated columnist, in a recent New York Times op-ed piece called Reagan's New Victory. You say that he is, I think you said, dangerously naive and mistaken. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I really resent the idea that some people's first thought upon the death of a former president is, let's see how we can use that to push our own political agenda today. And Safire does that by saying that Reagan's next victory, that's the name of the piece, would be for us to look at his death from Alzheimer's and realize that what we need to do is permit cloning for biomedical research and give more federal money to funding embryonic stem cell research. And he says, and he very quickly and breezily dismisses the idea of adult stem cell research. You know, we've talked about that several times on your program and the incredible breakthroughs going on there. And he just, you know, poo-poos it and just dismisses it. And let me show you what he says. He says in his piece, quote, some argue that we should see if adult stem cells may someday do the regenerative trick, but someday doesn't help today's victims. Well, what does that imply? That implies that cloning and embryonic stem cells can help today's victims. But that's just baloney. He's got it completely backwards. Cloning can't even be done hardly at all. It's been done once in South Korea, and certainly not reliably. And being able to extract embryonic stem cells from clones is a long ways off. Moreover, embryonic stem cells themselves have terrible problems that prevent them from being used in humans. They cause tumors, as one example, as we've discussed. They may be rejected, which would require cloning to try to overcome the rejection. On the other hand, adult stem cells and related experiments are just moving forward at breathtaking pace. But when you're basically got a religious belief, because that's what we're getting down to here, Todd. I'm convinced now that the empirical evidence for which of the approaches is actually working better and has the potential to bring cures to the clinic quicker. There's no question it's adult stem cells. If you look at the studies that are being published in the science journals, if you take a look at the heart patients, human heart patients currently being treated, Parkinson's patients that have been treated with very encouraging results. In Portugal, Lisbon, Portugal, Dr. Carlos Lima, you know, we hear a lot about Christopher Reeve, has treated spinal cord paralyzed people because of spinal cord injury with their own olfactory tissues. That is, he takes olfactory tissues, which are very filled with nerves. He crushes them. He has injected them into the damaged spinal cords, and people have regained some muscle control. They've regained bladder control. One patient that I read about even has been able to stand up using braces. This is huge stuff. Now, we don't know for sure that it's going to work. We have to make sure there aren't side effects and so forth, but that's just moving forward incredibly. You have nothing of the kind like that with embryonic stem cell research. Human adult spleen cells have cured juvenile diabetes in mice. These are mice with late-stage disease who were close to death, and they were cured. The New York Times didn't bother to report it. A study just came across my desk 2 days ago, 3 days ago, where they've been able to take bone marrow cells and transform them into liver cells. This is incredible. But it never gets discussed.
So how is this? Explain this to me, Wesley, because you can read more on the average in the average Newsweek week of news about, say, the benefits of the South Beach diet than you can about the benefits of adult stem cell
research and the things that are already being done with adult stem cells. At the same time, in the same paper, you'll be reading, as you said, about embryonic stem cell research, as though it were already producing cures. Couldn't be farther from the truth. What is at work, both in those who are reporting and those who are actually pushing the research?
Well, I think that what's happening is we're watching the emergence of a secular religion. It's called scientism. And there are people who fervently believe that science is the salvation of humankind. And then you've got the scientist members of this cult, if you will, who are so adamant that only they can decide what is moral and immoral in science, and are so furious that people like me are trying to thwart their agenda to be able to engage in human cloning for biomedical research and get tax money for embryonic stem cell research, that when the media calls them and says, but what about these adult stem cells, they routinely dismiss it, saying, oh, well, look, they can't change into all types of tissue, so embryonic is better, even though their own journals are reporting otherwise. And the media either accept this because they have the so-called credentials or are so caught up in the idea that the bad guys in this debate are the, quote, pro-lifers, even though there are people who are not pro-life on abortion who are on my side of the argument here, that they will then, and I'll give you an example in just a second of this, that they will then basically dismiss everything that the non-scientists are saying. But what's really richly ironic and bitterly so, in fact, is that often the scientists speak ideology, and it's called science because they have a science smock on, if you will. But people like me will quote actual science because we're forced to, among other things. Otherwise, we have no credibility. And because we're not, quote, scientists, it's called ideology, when it's often quite the contrary. I had I was interviewed for an hour and a half recently by Time Magazine for an article on the initiative we've talked about coming here in California that would force Californians to borrow $3 billion over 10 years to pay for human cloning research and embryonic stem cell research. And I talked to the reporter about all of the incredible breakthroughs happening, as we've discussed, in adult stem cell research and related tissue research. She then, and I said, you're misinformed. I don't want to get too specific as to who she was dealing with because it was private, but she was dealing with somebody from a disease, special interest group to try to push a disease. And I pointed out to her that a specific disease, you know, was actually benefiting way better with adult stem cells and embryonic stem cells. He wrote back and said that she had been right and I was wrong. So I was so angry because that was such baloney. I cited her from a very respected medical journal, a science journal. I cited the site. I put in quotes from the piece that basically said, this research means we may not have to use embryonic stem cells, that these adult cells could actually provide a cure. Basically summarizing what was said. And the response from this guy through this reporter was, oh, that's just one research. It doesn't a cure make. Well, it doesn't a cure make, but it did have cures in the animals that were used, and it showed an incredible animosity toward the fact that the science was moving in his disease category that this man supposedly advocates on behalf of, was moving for cures using adult cells, and he was bitter about it. All I could imagine was he has this religious view, it's a secular religion, that somehow this embryonic is the cure, and the people who oppose it are anti-science, when it's quite the contrary. It's magical thinking, Todd. It's not empirical analysis.
Give us some examples, if you would, about some of the real, you call them daunting challenges that face embryonic stem cell research and may well stand in the way of all these great promises that we so often hear in the press?
Well, first off, with embryonic stem cells, they can cause tumors. That is something that will not be solved with cloning. The other problem, major problem, is tissue rejection. And here's the issue. If I implanted embryonic stem cells in the same way that a body will reject an organ if that's transplanted, the body might reject the stem cells. So what do we have? We have a recent article in the Scientific American Written by, one of them was Robert Lanza, who's with Advanced Cell Technology, and the other one is a woman who teaches at a university about these issues. And they're saying that one of the ways out of this tissue rejection issue might have to be tissue typing. And here's what they say in their article from Scientific American. This isn't Wesley Smith. This is them in Scientific American. Quote, in order to do this tissue typing, you'd have to have, quote, hundreds of thousands of embryonic stem cell lines to establish a bank of cells with immune matches for most potential patients. Creating that many lines would require millions of discarded embryos from IVF clinics. Now, Lanza, we have to take what he just said and wrote it with a grain of salt because he wants therapeutic cloning, and that's what his company is pursuing. But if he's right about that, if one of the ways out of this rejection dilemma is tissue typing, well, we're not going to have millions of IVF embryos to create hundreds of thousands of embryonic stem cell lines. He then says, well, what we really should do is make a clone of each patient, and that with a clone of each patient, since most of the DNA taken from the embryos would match, then that will take care of the problem. But that's even more wildly improbable than taking a million embryos and making stem cells out of them. Because what you need in order to do cloning is a human egg. And right now, scientists are admitting that it would take just for one patient to get one embryonic stem cell line from a clone. Scientists have admitted in the National Academy of Sciences it would probably take at least 100 eggs, just human eggs, just to get the one cloned embryonic stem cell line. Well, that means if you're going to treat the 100 million Americans with degenerative conditions that cloning is supposed to be the panacea for, you'd need 10 billion human eggs. You're not going to get them. Right now, human eggs are selling for $1,000 to $2,000 each for IVF treatments and in vitro fertilization treatments. That would mean that just for the human eggs, nothing else, for therapeutic cloning, it would cost $200,000. And that doesn't include, Todd, the incredible increase in price that human eggs would bring if therapeutic cloning came onto the marketplace with a huge spike in demand for human eggs. Pretty soon we'd be exploiting the poor women of the world for their eggs, treating them as so many egg farms, right? I mean, this whole thing is dehumanizing. The only possible way out of that dilemma, it's a conundrum that can't be solved because human eggs are human eggs, is to use animal eggs. But that would mean that you would be putting animal mitochondrial DNA into human patients, and who knows what that would cause. It might cause rejection, which of course then does away with the whole purpose of therapeutic cloning, but it could cause disease.
Wesley, with only about 30 seconds here, you have talked about this science as religion. What happens when science as religion meets the facts, meets the empirical evidence? Sum this up for us.
Well, what I'm finding to my frustration is that facts don't matter because you have a faith system developing in which people don't want to be confused with the facts. There is an apparent rejection of empirical analysis on this subject. And we are on the bellows of Ronald Reagan's death is being used like a bellows to create hurricane-strength winds to support human cloning research and taxpayer support for human cloning research, as well as more taxpayer support for embryonic stem cell research. And the fact that that actually might slow development of cures because it could take resources and attention of scientists away from the adult and other similar approaches that are working doesn't concern people. All they know is embryonic is the answer, and no one's going to change their minds regardless of how many studies come down and how many human patients are helped through the adult transactions.
Folks, you can read the article, the recent column written for National Review Online by our guest Wesley Smith called Cell Wars at his website, wesleyjsmith.com. That's wesleyjsmith.com. Wesley, thank you again for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd. I appreciate it.
Wesley J. Smith is attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. He's senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, author of several books, including The Culture of Death, The Assault on Medical Ethics in America, and that column recently written on National Review Online called Cell Wars. You know, one of the things I think about when I have those, we have such frequent conversations with people like Wesley Smith on embryonic stem cell research, where I know the science can be confusing. And he started out by talking about how Nancy Reagan is at least in his mind, probably getting misinformation about embryonic stem cell research. One can hardly blame those who are misinformed about these things. That's why we do a program like this, so that you won't be misinformed. You know, would that Nancy Reagan could hear a program like this, where she could hear the truth about the difference between embryonic stem cell research and adult stem cell research, the difference between these two, one that requires the death of a human being with every stem cell, group of stem cells that is harvested, and the other that requires the death of no one and holds so much promise for the cures of those who are waiting for those cures. That's why we do a program like this. That's why we have people like Wesley Smith on here, so that we can inform you and everyone who's listening about the truth of those very issues. Before we end today's program, I would like you to consider joining our monthly donor program for Issues Etc. It's called the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. One of the unique features and one of the greatest strengths of Issues Etc. is the variety of topics and, of course, of guests that we cover in a, you know, we've only had 2 days here of Issues Etc. this week. I want to just run through this for you, just so you can be aware of it. In just the last 2 days, listen to these topics and the guests. The Doctrine of the Trinity in both the Old and the New Testament. We had Dr. Louis Brighton and Dr. Walter A. Meyer III. We talked with Phyllis Schlafly about the pro-life legacy of Ronald Reagan. We talked with former U.S. Attorney General Ed Meese about the passing of Ronald Reagan as well. We also, in the course of yesterday's program, talked with Illinois Congressman John Shimkus, got some of his thoughts there on the news of the day, and we brought you the latest in our series on working mothers with Suzanne Venker. That's just yesterday. Today, look at what we were doing today. Senator Jim Talent was with us early in the day to talk about President Ronald Reagan. We talked with Doug Johnson of National Right to Life about the injunction on the partial birth abortion ban. It's all there. Harry Potter was in there today as we talked with Pastor Todd Peppercorn, the presidency of Ronald Reagan with Senator Kit Bond, and we just heard also from Father Paul Orrin on what's going on in the Anglican Church of Canada and their issue with same-sex unions. There's Wesley Smith there at the end. That's 2 days, just 2 days, 6 hours of Issues Etc. It's all listener-supported. That's why we have the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. If you want to find out more about it, visit our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section, and you'll find more there. Or see page 12 of the latest Issues Etc. journal. You can become a confessor, an apologist, or a reformer and support the worldwide outreach, the variety of topics and guests that you hear on a day-to-day basis here on Issues Etc. Now, before we go, remember to tune in tonight at 8 for today's first hour rebroadcast of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.